Welcome, everybody, to a very special podcast. This is going to be part of our monthly series with Gary Young, screenwriter of Harry Brown, and we're going to be calling it tentatively the Gary Young Special. And our plan for these Gary Young Special podcasts is we are going to take two films that are either in the same franchise or remakes or spiritual cousins of each other, and we're going to be comparing and contrasting them. And for the first part of our compare contrast series, we're going to be discussing Michael Mann's Manhunter and Jonathan Demme's Silence of the Lambs. I'm joined with Nick.
How you guys doing?
And there he is. And particularly, of course, Gary is with us. Gary, how's it going?
I'm good. I'm fine. Thank you.
Excellent. So we discussed prior to recording that we'll also graze over Brett Ratner's remake, I guess you could call it a remake of Manhunter, Red Dragon, and as well as the television series Hannibal and Ridley Scott's film Hannibal. And we may get into a little bit of Hannibal Rising. I don't know how familiar. I think, Gary, you've seen the whole thing. I don't know if you have, Nick. Have you?
I've only seen it once. I remember a decent amount. I thought it was not very good.
Right.
I mean, yeah. And especially when compared to the other stuff. I mean, you know, it just doesn't... I mean, I didn't... Yeah, it just felt undistinguished, you know, comparatively speaking.
I have the same. I watched it one night on TV. I can tell you very little. My memory is very shady about it. I would need to rewatch it again. The only thing I kind of remember watching, I think Rhys Evans is in it. The British Welsh actor Rhys Evans. And that's the only thing I remember. It kind of looked like some sort of cheapish movie. It didn't. As I say, you have to put a gun to my head to tell you what. it's the one novel I hadn't read of the Thomas Harris.
Yeah.
It's the one I haven't read. So, we can, other than that, that's about as much as I can tell you about it.
Right. I started reading the novel and I didn't finish because I didn't like it, and then I never saw the film because I knew the film wasn't going to be very good. It was interesting when that came out because it was announced as a film before the book was even published, and Harris wrote the screenplay for it, and it was the first screenplay he's written. So it was just kind of interesting considering he didn't have any involvement whatsoever in any of the previous films of the Hannibal Lecter franchise.
Well, he's a very interesting character, Thomas Harris, because there's very little known about him. He seems almost a recluse. You could pretty much get no interviews with him, and he doesn't really comment on his work. And there's stories that I've heard about him that he really had enough of the whole Hannibal thing by the time he'd, with the whole, when the Silence of the Lambs thing, this huge problem, which it did, and he wanted to write a completely different novel. And the story goes, and how true this is, I don't know. But the story is that, you know, his agent said, mate, if you write another Hannibal novel, you'll never have to work for the rest of your life again. And so he did. And I don't know whether you've both read the novel of Hannibal.
I have, yeah.
And I won't spoil it, but for anyone who hasn't, it has a very distinctive ending, which is very different from the Hannibal movie. And he did that deliberately to end what he wanted to do was end the franchise by ending the novel the way he did, which is not the same end of the novel of the movie. I think that's right. Isn't it? It's a different ending.
Yeah, much different.
Yeah, and he deliberately ended it to write no more about it, and then obviously something was to happen down the line because he did the Hannibal Rising. So that was my kind of little knowledge of the Hannibal and the Hannibal, the Ridley Scott movie. And apparently that's the reason why Jodie Foster didn't do the movie, Hannibal the sequel, because she didn't buy the ending of the novel.
Hmm.
And she just went, no, that's not how, I don't believe that, well, the character would do that. Which is kind of interesting.
And I absolutely love the ending of Hannibal the movie. I think,
of course you do.
I think it's crazy and wild and hysterical, and I'll just blanket statement. I've read zero of the books that any of these movies are based on. I've,
oh, well,
I just watched. I'm not a book reader. I'm a movie watcher. So I can't compare anything from the book to the movies. I'm literally looking at them as pieces of cinema.
Well, I should actually say what's really it happens. All the Manhunter, Silence, and Hannibal, Silence particularly, but actually Manhunter to most of them, pretty much follow the novels almost word for word. I mean, the dialogue from Silence of the Lambs is literally lifted from the novel. All that back and forth is Thomas Harris. And Hannibal, the movie is pretty much the same, except for a very key moment, and it's not what's his name having his head eaten. It's the last closing moment to the book, and it's what happens to the Clarice Sterling character, which was incredibly controversial when it came out. And I remember reading the novel before I saw the movie, everybody talking about what Thomas Harris did to the Clarice Sterling character, which is different to what happens to, it just kind of, you know, what happens to her, and that she just carries on.
It's not a cinematic ending.
No, it's not. It's a very strange, cerebral ending, that kind of...
Right.
That, and Thomas Harris did it deliberately, like Sherlock Holmes when he supposedly tried to kill him off, and Ian Fleming did it in the Bond novels. He just got tired, didn't want to write about it anymore, so he put this very odd ending on.
What I think is also interesting about just a blanket statement about the entire series of films is that, you know, while they share nothing in common with a franchise like, you know, Mission Impossible, each one of the movies in the series for, you know, between the filmmaker that was a part of making it or the year that it was came out, they all feel so different. And, you know, I just can't help but feel that it's like one of those series, almost like the Alien series in a way, where you have all these really unique filmmaking voices that are, you know, striving to tell one coherent universal story about, you know, this group of people. And I just think it's, you know, another unique spin on the whole Hannibal Lecter, you know, Clarice Starling, you know, Graham, you know, the whole thing. I just think that the whole universe is unique in that sense.
I think that has to do, and I would stick up for the writer. It has to, I mean, you know, having read the novels, how Thomas Harris's vision is, and like, you know, what great writing does is it can be interpreted in such diverse ways. I mean, when we're about to talk about Manhunter and Silence, and both of them are almost yin and yang to each other in their visual, the way in which the directors interpret the material.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, they're literally, I mean, actually, I do think, and I've heard he was very deliberate of it, Jonathan Demme deliberately did everything the opposite of Michael Mann. You know, the obvious thing is this Hannibal cell, which in, you know, is this an amazing kind of white, almost sterile environment that Mann just made. It's almost like he's in a operating theater. I mean, he looks like he's wearing kind of scrubs. And Jonathan Demme goes for this dark, gothic, in the basement, kind of looks like the set from the Universal Frankenstein movie. Apparently the set is based on drawings and of the that they've got of the cell in Spandau Prison where they kept some of the German prisoners. You know, some of the Nazi war criminals like Hess and people like that. And apparently that it's based on these kind of drawings that someone had done of kind of Spandau Prison. And that was one of the...
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Neither did I.
Yeah, so one of the documentaries, and one of the I forgot the name of the art designer, who's just does a blinding job. I mean, I always think the Hannibal movies are an art director's wet dream, because, you know, they've got this amazing material to create all these... I mean, both of them are both Manhunter and Silence. Their art direction in both of them is incredible, and the photography... It's in Manhunter. It's what do they call him? The Italian guy,
Dante Spinotti. He did both of them, right?
Did he do Silence?
No, I'm sorry. He did. He did Red Dragon, the Brett Ratner remake.
Brett Ratner has pictures, compromising pictures of Dante Spinotti that he holds over his head because for some reason Dante Dante Spinotti continuously works with the ultra hack Brett Ratner, which I can just never figure out. It's like Ratner is the ultimate schmoozer. Like, he just must go into these rooms and just charm everyone with his smile and like the tales of like his sexual exploits with women, and they just must give him jobs because of it. There couldn't be any more of a vanilla director that, in my opinion, has like ever been around than Brett Ratner.
I mean, I'll get to
Ratner's defense. I think Red Dragon's his best film.
Oh, I was just about to say, it is light years his best movie. I mean,
but that being said, I think Red Dragon is completely uninspired.
I mean, it's,
and forced.
I don't want this to become the Brett Ratner podcast of all things, but I can't compare him. I can't compare his work to that of somebody like Jonathan Demme or Ridley Scott or Michael Mann. It's just not even. It's not even in the same stratosphere. And the thing that really takes me back too, and I wanted to get into Gary's point before about how how Demme didn't want to do anything like Mann. I'm always blown away by how Demme frames people in the scene, about how they're always in the middle of the frame as opposed to the left or right, which you're told in film school, always have somebody on the left or right.
And they're close up.
And at these, like, he did it in The Manchurian Candidate as well, in his remake, which I really enjoyed. His, like, this weird, unsettling sort of just off kilter, and they're in the middle of this frame, and you're not expecting to see someone's head like that in a close up. It just really gets under your skin.
Oh, I mean, it is full of these incredible, almost Sergio Leone-like close-ups. I mean, the bulk of the movie, which is almost everybody's first introduction, is this huge, massive facial close-up. If you watch, when we cut first to Scott Glenn, when he's talking, you know, when she comes, he pulls her off the assault course, and it cuts straight into Scott Glenn, and he looks literally what they call down the bottle in English. In English, symbol, we say down the bottle, which is right down the lens, and says the line, you know, you don't want Hannibal Lecter in your head. And then it cuts to this huge close-up of Shelton saying, oh, he's a monster. And, you know, the whole thing is constructed around these amazing facial close-ups, which is...
Yeah,
The whole dialogue between... And if you watch each time, and it's a really interesting thing what he does... is each time a conversation happens between Clarice Sterling and Hannibal, the close-ups get tighter and tighter and tighter, till eventually the last exchange, which is when she gives it up and tells him the silence of the lambs, what it all means, is literally their faces filling the screen. And that is because he's in her head. It's such a beautifully constructed film. I mean, it is... I argue with probably not perfect.
I agree with you. I love the breaking of the fourth wall in Silence of the Lambs with the characters addressing the camera. And I do agree with you that Silence of the Lambs is one of the handful of films that I consider the perfect film. It is 100% flawless. There is nothing that could be improved upon in the film. Before we get too carried away with everything, let's just, I want to do a brief intro of the film Manhunter. I think that the film is probably more well known now, and a lot more people have seen it than prior. But for those people who haven't seen it or don't know much about it, it was a film that came out in 1986, and it was directed by Michael Mann, and Michael Mann also wrote the screenplay. And it stars William Peterson, Joan Allen, Tom Noonan, Dennis Farina, Stephen Lang, a lot of Michael Talbot's in it, a lot of Michael Mann regulars. And Brian Cox plays Hannibal Lecter in the film, and they misspell his name from the novel Red Dragon, which I always thought was interesting. What the film is about is... the film's about Will Graham, who's a retired FBI profiler, and when the book and the film came out, there wasn't terminology for a profiler. I think he was called a forensic specialist or something like that in the film and in the novel. That terminology wasn't even in existence, which I think makes the film important in a way. It deals with Will Graham's retirement and how Jack Crawford, his old boss from the FBI, lures him out of retirement because there is a serial killer on the loose that the FBI cannot catch. And he's on a lunar cycle, and once a month he goes into a home and kills everybody and does all sorts of fucked up shit to them. And Graham gets lured back into it, and he goes to visit Hannibal Lecter, who Graham was the one who caught Lecter, albeit somewhat accidentally, because when Graham worked as a profiler for the FBI, Hannibal Lecter was his consultant, and he would consult with Lecter about the killings and him trying to find the serial killer that ended up being Lecter. The film is very... I've seen this movie easily over 100 times. Anybody who knows me knows, like, I am absolutely obsessed with this film. I have a poster up of it in my place. I have every Region 1 DVD that got released. I have the Blu-ray. I haven't bought the UK Blu-ray that Nick just purchased. But this is very interesting. This is definitely, when you watch this film, it's definitely a Michael Mann film. And you know it's a Michael Mann film, from the color tones to the heavy tones that he uses to score the film, and from his stylized direction and editing. I've read a lot of reviews of it, and now the film is hailed with overly positive reviews, but upon its initial release, it was compared heavily to Miami Vice, and it was when Mann left the TV show Miami Vice, he went to make this film, and then the TV show Crime Story that starred Dennis Farina. But there's a lot of, I would say, complaints that this film is laced with the style of Miami Vice.
It was when it came, I remember when it came, and it was like blink and you missed it at the cinema, and it got a very short theatrical release. And it was basically sold as in the UK, and the Red Dragon books, the Thomas Harris novels didn't have the phenomenon that they do now, and it was basically called Miami Vice with serial killers. That was, and I remember all the reviews at the time being incredibly, it's just Miami Vice the movie, and it really came and went. Most people discovered it in post Silence and went back and rediscovered it. And also, I watched it on video when it came out, and I didn't see it at the cinema. And I watched it, and I didn't know anything about the novels. And I remember watching it for the first time. And one of those where you're going, this is a really interesting movie. Why is everybody not picking up on this? I didn't realize until Silence of the Lambs came out that it was the connection. And it was only afterwards that I realized, I've seen that film. I didn't know that was anything to do with the Hannibal Lecter and everything after Silence. So I kind of revisited it. It is very kind of Michael Mann. I mean, it is his fingerprints all over it. It's kind of aged much better than I think. I watched it just recently because of this, and I've seen the film like a gazillion times, like you, Frank, and I rewatched it recently, and it's aged actually a lot better than I would give it credit for, given how kind of aged and stylized it.
Oh, for sure.
And I think it was two things that help it was. It, again, with the performances, how brilliant Brian Cox is in it. Cox is brilliant as Lecter. Completely the opposite, polar opposite of what Anthony Hopkins does. He does everything almost, the two of them do everything the opposite to each other. And they both work equally as well. And I love, Cox's decision to play it almost chillingly offhand. I mean, he's just kind of smiling and seems almost... my favorite line, which I always added to Dream Much, Will, and the way he just throws everything away, and yet you are equally as chilled to the bone with him. when he's talking to the woman on the phone, and he sneaks Will Graham's number, and they're chatting to the woman, and he's all dead friendly, and there's just, you know, all of that amazing white cell, and the way he just kind of holds Will Graham's through the bars. Also, again, which is again, you know, you can, which is William Peterson, who does a brilliant job as Will Graham. It's kind of his audition for CSI, really, in a way.
It is,
And it's, you kind of feel sorry. I was thinking he was a bit cheated, Will. I don't know what happened, because there was a big chunk of his career that he just didn't do anything that anyone had heard of, and I don't know whether it was the Miami Vice where they had him dolled up, but it kind of, I think Miami Vice didn't do Manhunter any favors at the time because of Michael Mann's huge association, which was a revolutionary television show at the time.
And didn't William Peterson come from To Live and Die in L.A. straight from that movie to Manhunter?
That's why he was cast.
Because I think that between those two performances, those are, for me, those are his two best performances, and Manhunter, I think, is his best. And I think that what Mann saw in him was exactly what Mann sees in all of his male protagonists, from De Niro and Pacino in Heat to, you know, Tom Cruise in Collateral to Colin Farrell in, you know, the big screen version of Miami Vice. He fits that prototypical man mold, the quiet, stoic, you know, guy who's going to get the job done, and he's dedicated. And, you know, Manhunter is a film that I have seen the least, other than The Keep, which I've only seen once on video. Manhunter is a movie, and I'm a huge Michael Mann fan, it's the one I've seen the least amount of times, and revisiting it this weekend for the first time in a long time, I was struck by how the movie really just felt like, even in some ways more so than you know, I'm trying to think about, but Thief was before, right?
Yeah, Thief, The Keep, and then Manhunter.
Thief, The Keep, then Manhunter. So even more so than Thief, you know, other than the James Caan, you know, male character, again, fitting that mold for Mann and his leading guys, the movie really felt like a warm-up for what we traditionally now know as the Michael Mann aesthetic. And that, for me, was just so exciting to sort of see in retrospect, because I was, I became a Mann disciple, you know, when I was 15, when I saw Heat, and then with The Insider, and those were two movies that really just, you know, were constant rewatches for me, and I learned a lot about, you know, movies in general just from those two films. So to watch it again in retrospect and to see how different it is from Silence of the Lambs, which I've seen a lot, and had a chance actually in college to watch it more or less frame by frame with one of my professors during a seminar, which was a fantastic experience. He actually showed us David Fincher's Seven and Jonathan Demme's The Silence of the Lambs, because the guy felt, and I absolutely agree, and to your point before, Silence of the Lambs is a perfect movie. It may not be for you, it may not be your cup of tea, but you can't improve on any part of that movie. And I think that's one of the main reasons why it did win the Oscar that year over something like, you know, JFK, which was so sprawling and, you know, could easily be divisive for many people. I just think that there was no getting around the fact that The Silence of the Lambs was just so strong. But getting back to Manhunter, really, really interesting to see the differences in the performances between Brian Cox and later Anthony Hopkins. And I love and I said in my written piece earlier, like the geometric precision of the visuals and how Mann's obsession with architecture and space and how people are framed within the shot really just became very abundantly clear to me that this was like his calling card film.
I mean, I think, man, I so agree with Nick, because Manhunter does look like you can see the genesis of what the artist is about to become. And I would argue that probably, you know, every filmmaker has what I call their Sgt. Pepper album, right? The one that they're always going to be known for. And it's like Mann's is always going to be Heat. You know, that's going to be the movie. It's like, you know, it's going to be the
Me
movie.
Too.
It is, and not that she's, you know, it's the kind of definitive Michael Mann movie for every, you know, it's the fact that it's got Al Pacino and, but you can see the genesis of where he's going in Manhunter and in Thief. Funny enough, if you kind of look at those two movies, Manhunter and Heat, you can see why he's going to get to. You can see with Manhunter.
Exactly. And, they're great companion pieces.
Yeah, they are, because they look, they almost look like, I mean, it's, you know, it's really interesting that, because you, you know that Heat itself is a remake of a TV movie that's called LA Takedown that Michael Mann did for TV. It's the same script, but just different.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he kind of, it all looks like this sort of dress rehearsal that he's kind of working his way up to making Heat. And you're right about, you know, the Will Graham character is a direct line to what Pacino would become in Heat. He has, you know, as you said, and William Peterson is a, such a kind of, you know, Michael Mann actor, Michael Mann lead actor. And I after those two performances, and, you know, I could talk forever about To Live and Die in L.A., because I think that's one of the great undiscovered 80s movies, right? And there's a huge...
I agree. I think it's incredible.
It's, you know, I know Billy Friedkin. I work with Bill a little bit, so I know him. So I know quite a bit. Billy told us all about that, and the whole huge, because of, you know, interesting, we're talking about this thing with because there was a huge issue with To Live and Die in LA being compared to Miami Vice, because everybody, it was, both came out at the same time, both were like MTV cops who took, you know, this very stylized, suddenly this very different view of cops looking very stylish, and it's, and there, at the time there was almost, there was a lawsuit practically went on in which Friedkin was going to be sued by the Miami Vice producers and vice versa, because everybody thought, which was ridiculous. And Billy said the whole thing was just, you know, stupid. But it was interesting that coming out of that, out of this tension between them, and it, and Miami Vice, the movie, kind of killed LA, To Live and Die in LA a little bit. It killed its took its thunder a bit by just a few months. But what's interesting, out of all that, who does Michael Mann cast? The opposition is William Peterson to put him in to play Will Graham. I have to say the you know what and I don't really want to talk about the sort of Red Dragon remake. Now, what's interesting about the Red Dragon remake? The cast is a stellar cast. I mean, the Red Dragon is, it's got a cast.
Yeah,
of
Brett Ratner always gets a stellar cast. He always gets a stellar cast and a great cinematographer, and then somehow makes a 2-star movie.
I mean, you've got everybody, you know, and also, but here's the interesting thing. You have, as the Tooth Fairy, in the Brett Ratner one, you have Ralph Fiennes. Now, Ralph Fiennes is probably one of the best British actors going, right? He's in the tradition of Olivier and following the traditions of all those great guys. And you have him as the bad guy, and he's brilliant as the bad guy. But man, he's not Tom Noonan. He doesn't even stand scary, scary guy. And Noonan is brilliant as Francis Dolhydron. You know, that guy's acting, you know, Ralph Fiennes is acting being Francis Dolhydron. Tom Noonan is Francis Dolhydron. And the story is, when they were making it, he just got so method with the whole part, Noonan. He wouldn't relate to anybody, and Mann indulged it because he loved that. And apparently he wouldn't be referred to as, he had to be just, you know, knocked on the door. It was almost, he almost directed him in sign language, because Noonan didn't want, he got so deep into this part. And him and Will Graham, William Peterson, only met at the very end of the movie, where he jumps through the window. That was the only moment, and that was the last shot that they both had, is the bit where he kills him and he breaks into the kitchen at the end, and he says, and then he went for breakfast. But Noonan commits to that part, and everything about him is perfect. The fact that he's very tall and strange looking, just as a person, the actor Tom Noonan, and it is a genuinely scary performance. I believe every moment to it. And also, I love his chemistry with,
Joan Allen.
Allen, Jesus. I mean, that's an amazing relationship. I think that's one of the first things Joan Allen ever did, isn't it?
I had forgotten that she was in it, and I'm a big Joan Allen fan, and I had totally forgotten when I was watching it this weekend. I was taken aback by how young she was, and always how great she is.
she's amazing. That whole sequence and the kind of love scene she has where she kisses him and they're watching the it's an amazing moment, electric moment. I remember watching the movie and just going, this is so strange, when I saw it for the first time, and I kind of didn't get it. And as I say, I think Noonan is quite brilliant in it, and scary, and at times you kind of feel for him a little bit. It's a brilliant performance. It's genuinely great performance. And as I say, Noonan apparently, you know, totally methoded it.
Yeah, Noonan is absolutely terrifying in it. I mean, absolutely terrifying. And you're dead on with Ralph Fiennes. I think Ralph Fiennes is one of the better things about the Red Dragon film. I think Ralph Fiennes is one of the best parts. As far as that cast goes, it's very interesting because that cast is phenomenal. And
couldn't afford them now, darling. I mean, imagine that
right
now, paying all those guys.
And they got Ted Talley to write the screenplay, who wrote the screenplay to Silence of the Lambs. But what's interesting is Edward Norton's uninspired in the film. It's abundantly clear, I think, from anybody who watches it, that he is doing that movie for the paycheck. And as much as I love Harvey Keitel,
I think he wanted something of his own greenlit. And the story.
Yeah, I think he rolled all the money he got from that into 25th Hour.
Yeah,
that's what I've read.
Yeah, there was something like that he I'll do because that happens a lot. And I remember reading him saying, "Listen, they agreed, and it was a 25th Hour something he'd agreed, and they would greenlit the personal project he wanted." And he kind of looks like he's sort of going through it a little bit.
And as much as I love. As much as I love Harvey Keitel, the guy's one of my favorite actors. Him as Jack Crawford, I mean, he should be a good Jack Crawford, but there's just, I'm not inspired by the Crawford. I mean, I love Dennis Farina, and I love Scott Glenn as Crawford. They're two different Crawfords. They're very interesting. Scott Glenn is the bureaucrat Crawford, and the, you know what I mean, the intellectual Crawford, and then Farina's the street cop.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
Because Dennis Farina was a real policeman.
Right, exactly. And he met Mann and worked as a consultant on Thief.
Well, you know the story that where, we're digressing the man a little bit, but he is inspired by a story that Dennis Farina told him, or was introduced to a policeman who told Michael Mann a story about when he was working robbery. And he was out at a ball game one day, and he looked across, and there was this guy who he knew was a warrant out for him, who was a professional thief. And he was out at this ball game with his wife and kids. And the cop walked up to him, and he didn't know whether he going to arrest the guy in front of his kids. And he said to him, "Let's have a cup of coffee." And they sat while they watched the ball game. His wife talked to each other, and they spoke for about 20 minutes, and they found they had so much in common. And the guy just shook his hand and said, "Next time I see you, the cuffs are going on." And the guy went, you know, he said something, "Yeah, listen, mate, next time I won't be so nice about it." And that was where the essence of Heat come from. And Dennis Farina told that apocryphal story to Michael Mann, and Mann, that's where Heat was born, on the set of Manhunter.
That's amazing.
That's where it all kind of came from. Do you know the other story about Silence of the Lambs? Do you know who was supposed to do it, though? Who had the rights for years and didn't make it?
I read that it was Gene Hackman,
Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman was supposed. He was going to direct. He was going to play Crawford. Michelle Pfeiffer was supposed to play Clarice Sterling, and John Lithgow was going to be cast as Hannibal. And so, and I think someone talked Hackman out of it, and he dropped the project. I bet he kind of regretted that one a little bit. But yeah,
I'm sure
Hackman had rights to it for years apparently, and was kind of planning to do a sort of Clint Eastwood with it, and dropped the project, and Jonathan Demme kind of picked it up. And of course, when Silence of the Lambs came out, nobody had any expectations for that. I mean, Jonathan Demme was an off-the-wall kind of indie director. He wasn't a major director.
No one you could pin down, certainly, as having any sort of, not that I mean, I loved his films, but you're absolutely right. He's an idiosyncratic filmmaker who's bounced around from genre to genre and form to form.
Yeah, and he hadn't done anything that was particularly box office. His movies were off-the-wall indie that had some names in it. You know, Married to the Mob, and probably, the one he did with Melanie Griffiths?
Something Wild
was probably his best kind of movie in terms of, I know he did some sort of documentaries. It wasn't like, shall we say, David Cronenberg, who you would go, oh yeah, that material fits. And also as well, Anthony Hopkins was a kind of, was a Brit actor who showed a lot of promise and was a theatrical actor, but wasn't the name that he became because of Hannibal. And also Jodie Foster wasn't the leading actress at that point. Neither of them, nothing in that movie that was getting made said it was going to win a bunch of Oscars and be a huge phenomenon. It just was so off the radar of how it became. That's total kind of word of mouth how the film got caught up with. And it's really, and I think Demi almost got the film by default. I don't think it was something that anybody had any faith in or anything. It's not a movie that you would naturally go, oh, we'll cast that guy.
Right.
And he never did anything really that great again.
No, he didn't. I mean, what's his, Rachel Getting Married? I loved Rachel Getting Married.
Me too. I am a huge fan of that. But yeah, it's you're absolutely right.
Demi veered off into making, you know, concert documentaries and stuff. He's done a lot of that post Silence, and he was supposed to do that. He was supposed to do that Stephen King novel, the adaptation for a studio. I can't remember which one. It was about the Kennedy assassination.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then it got turned into the Hulu series that somehow James Franco is going to spearhead. But his new movie, Ricky and the Flash, looks good. But that looks a lot like Something Wild, Married to the Mob, small indie caliber.
Yeah, he's, you know, I mean, that's what Jonathan is. He's that guy. He's the kind of quirky indie guy. And I can imagine probably someone didn't really, the opposite of what Brett Ratner is. Not to bash that guy, poor guy, but... there's the studio system, and you have to have a certain mindset to work in that environment. You have to be part of that. You have to be a kind of player and part of that world. And if that's not you, if that's not how you create your movies, you're just going to get lost. Because, you know, one thing you don't see it about 12 execs telling you, we think the girl needs to have green hair, not have green hair. You just go, oh, yeah. And, you know, Jonathan Demme strikes me as a guy who says, no, she has green hair. You know, next thing you know, nobody's returning your calls. So I don't know anything about Jonathan Demme, but I'm assuming from his background and who he is, he's just not that guy. And Silence, I'd imagine the Hitler Silence probably surprised him as much as anybody. And he's a brilliantly interesting director. But it's still the best thing he's ever done.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I don't think Demme or a lot of filmmakers will ever achieve the height they do, or Demme did with Silence of the Lambs. Everything about Silence of the Lambs is absolutely amazing. I mean, I'm one of those people that prefer Manhunter over Silence of the Lambs, but I know that Silence of the Lambs is a better movie. You brought up earlier, Gary, Brian Cox's portrayal as Hannibal Lecter. I absolutely love it. It's interesting, the two different Lecters that are in the novel as well as both films. I look at Hannibal Lecter and Manhunter as a villain. Yeah. He's a straight-up villain. Yeah. He wants Will Graham and his entire family dead. He wants to mentally destroy Will Graham where they share that scene together, and then they have the phone conversation towards the end of the film. He hates Will Graham because Will Graham caught him, and he knows Will Graham isn't smarter than he is. It's a very interesting dynamic between Graham and Lecter, and it's much different with Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, and even with Lecter's portrayal, or Anthony Hopkins' portrayal as Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. He's very campy and hammy at times.
Oh, it's an incredibly theatrical performance.
It is.
And kind of knowingly so. It's Hopkins is kind of knowingly... I'll tell you the interesting thing, which about 2 or 3 years before he did Hannibal, he won a bunch of awards and he did a play called Pravda, which was a very famous play he did in London. I think he might have even took it to New York. And he played this awful kind of South African newspaper editor. And it's a real parody on... It's kind of got that network feel to it about scandal newspapers and everything. That was very big in kind of the 80s and sort of 90s in the UK. And it was written by this big playwright. And Hopkins played this South African, awful South African kind of newspaper baron. But if you ever saw that play and saw the performance he gives in Silence of the Lambs, there's a kind of, you can see the DNA of what Hopkins obviously built up having fun playing that character, and then started to use it in Hannibal, the slick back hair and that kind of shark like kind of stare that he does, and it's very theatrical and very big, and kind of, you know, universal kind of monster big. But that performance wouldn't work. You couldn't put that performance into Manhunter. But at the same time, you can't do it the other way around, because Cox's performance wouldn't work against Jodie Foster in Silence.
No.
Because he wouldn't have been the boogeyman to her. He has to be the boogeyman to her. Brian Cox doesn't need to be the boogeyman because he's already, you know, had that duel. And so, you know, the decision to make Hopkins, to make him into this, literally, you know, this monster, this Frankenstein, Dracula, all these elements in there, is so right for that one movie, for Silence, and the tone that they take. And you're right, he isn't the villain. And that's a brilliant observation. You're right, and he's so the villain in Manhunter, and he isn't. He's almost like the love interest. He is the love interest.
Yeah, by the time Hannibal comes around, he's a romantic lead.
Yeah, he is. But he says like 3 times to her. I mean, he says to her, people will say we're in love. You know, he touches her hand. And his last line to her is, I won't be visiting you because the world is a better place with you in it. She says, you know, Doctor, he kills Minx for her. Who hisses at her, I can smell your cunt. And that's his first show of affection. He kills the guy for you're right. He's the romantic lead, and he kills Miggs for her. He gets him to swallow his tongue, and she indulges it and almost gets off on it, on this relationship with each other. It's in the book, which is not in the movie. Crawford's wife is dying, and he keeps going every time she goes to see him. Crawford's wife is getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And even she thinks about, you know, their relationship and everything. And it's too distracting. But Hannibal picks up on it because he talks about it, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He constantly challenges her about her sexuality and about her attractiveness. About her, how she feels. Time as well, one of the reasons why Hackman dropped the project was because he was talked out of it because people thought it was incredibly misogynistic and that it was also homophobic. And that was one of the reasons why Hackman said he didn't want to do it. I'm not sure whether I see that in the movie.
I don't.
No. You know, their lead is, you know, she's a woman. How much strong can you get as Jodie Foster?
Right. No, I don't see those themes at all. It's interesting. And to real quick bring up how you were saying that Hopkins, Lecter wouldn't work in Manhunter, and Cox's Lecter wouldn't work in Silence of the Lambs, you're dead on. I also think part of the reason is they're two different Lecters. They're at two different points in their life. I think solitary confinement and interaction without, or not having interaction with other people, got to Lecter in a way in Silence of the Lambs, and I think that's a reflection of Lecter's campiness and hamminess, as well as Anthony Hopkins putting his own spin on it. But in the film Red Dragon, Hopkins plays that same Lecter, and I don't think it works. Plus in Red Dragon, before I get into that, the thing that makes Lecter such a great character is his limited screen time. He has very little screen time. He has three scenes, small scenes in Manhunter, but he is such a present character throughout the whole film. Silence of the Lambs, what's his total runtime? It's like 15 minutes or something like that.
15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's vastly short compared to Foster and even Scott Glenn, but at the same token, Hannibal Lecter is throughout the entire film, even when he's not on the screen. With Red Dragon, they expanded Lecter a lot. Because, of course, we got Anthony Hopkins back to play Hannibal Lecter.
And in Hannibal,
the main character
in Hannibal.
He finally gets
his own movie, yeah.
Right, but with Red Dragon, that's another thing I think that's a huge fault in the film, among others, is the overuse of Hannibal Lecter. The whole scene where Edward Norton goes to see Anthony Hopkins, and Anthony Hopkins is in that gymnasium, and he's tied up, or whatever, where he's allowed to walk those laps or whatever, and it's just too much, and even the dialogue's made up, because that dialogue never happened in the novel Red Dragon. A lot of Lecter's dialogue in Red Dragon, and I think that severely hurts the film and takes away a lot of its power by having the overuse of Lecter. In regards to the film Hannibal, I think that's an unbalanced film. I think that film was an uphill battle for pretty much anybody to make. I think Ridley Scott did the best he could with it. The fact that Jonathan Demme didn't direct it and they had to replace Starling, I mean, I think that hurt the film quite a bit. I think Julianne Moore does the best job she possibly could, but I mean, that'd be like replacing Anthony Hopkins, and I know that it was talked about that Tim Roth was the replacement for Anthony Hopkins. But I mean,
there's something about Julianne Moore that she doesn't have. There's a vulnerability and a strength to Jodie Foster. She has. The two things in equal measure. And there's something incredibly poised and incredibly beautiful about Julianne Moore, who looks like a supermodel.
It also has to do with the visual style of Hannibal. I mean, that movie is Ridley Scott making love to every frame of the film, from the Italian scenery to John Matheson's lush and really, really artistic cinematography. I mean, you're right. She looks like a supermodel in the film, and it's just it's like so hard to compare Hannibal to Silence of the Lambs because they were completely different movies in almost every respect.
Yeah, it comes from a different place. It does. It takes a different place.
And this is like, and that was right after Ridley had done Black Hawk Down, I think. So he had gone from doing this epic, massive, you know, war film, and then he gets to go to Italy and shoot the hell out of Italy. And, you know, I could just see the sensibility of him after such a massive production, you know, just wanting to sort of make this painterly gorgeous, you know, riff on material. I just think it's such a great black comedy, and I'm glad that I think you guys both think it's funny, right?
Yeah, bowels out.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, my problem with it is actually, and it's my problem, and it is you've hit the nail on the head, Nick. It is a black comedy. My problem with the whole with Hannibal ultimately becomes a parody of the. It becomes like the casino. You know, they ever seen that the other night? You know, the Casino Royale. Have you seen the 60s
yes.
one? it kind of borderline. It's like the version of.
It's a caricature.
It is, and Ridley's not saying, and Ridley kind of goes there with it, and the whole thing becomes, you're right, a kind of black comedy version of what, right to, you know, eating Ray Liotta's brains at the end and everything.
And feeding the little kid on the plane. That's the part that's your last scene of the movie. It's so nasty. I love it.
I mean, it does go there. It reminds me actually of, I don't know, you guys are way too young. There was in the 70s, there was a whole series of these British horror movies, like the Dr. Fives with Vincent Price, in which Vincent Price would always play this sort of mad genius who would be wronged by a group of either theatre critics or his woody, and he would wreak revenge on them in these most bizarre kind of murders that was got more and more ludicrous as it went on. It's what the Saw movies are ripped off. And kind of Hannibal sort of reminded me of that. It became it became more and more and more ludicrous. Silence felt like a real world, or at least a world that you kind of recognize, and it's all shot.
Definitely agree, yeah.
And it's all these autumn colors and beautiful browns and this really nice rich photography, but everybody looks real world faces. You know, there's something very, very kind of genuine about it. You can feel, you can smell the world, and you go, yeah, I could walk around that town. Hannibal just wasn't. Hannibal just became, as you said, Ridley, which is what Ridley's amazing at doing. Italy looked like more than Italy. It looked like,
yes,
the idealized Italy. The violence was more, was bigger and bigger and bigger. And I was always a bit disappointed in Hannibal because of that. I think when I saw it at the cinema, I found it like, this is getting silly.
The omission of Jack Crawford I didn't like either. I think Jack Crawford plays an important part, maybe not a crucial part, but he plays an important part in the novel. I mean, Crawford dies in the novel.
Yes.
And the same goes for Margot Verger, Mason's sister. I think she's an incredibly important character to the arc of the story of Hannibal. I will say, though, I think the best part of the film Hannibal is Gary Oldman's performance as Mason Verger. I think he's just disgusting. He's absolutely disgusting, and he's incredible.
When he says nobody beats the Riz, it's one of my absolute favorite lines in any movie ever. I love him in that movie. The disgusting makeup they put on him, the sense of glee that he seems to have under that makeup. I love it.
No.
Yeah, he's just this disgusting little thing in a wheelchair that doesn't have a face. I mean, he doesn't have a face or eyelids or anything, and like three wisps of hair that's pulled into a ponytail. he's the monster of the film, which is a great structure. Well, and of the novel too. It's a great structure. With making Hannibal the anti-hero again. It's Mason Verger that's truly the villain.
Yeah, because it's wonderful, because it's what Gary Oldman does is he outperforms Anthony Hopkins as the over-and-top villain. And if you're going to get someone to do that, you're going to get Gary Oldman. And you're right, he's actually probably the best thing in it. And so, he just, everything from the makeup and the way Oldman plays it, and that strange voice he kind of inhabits, and the whole tone, you're right, and he's like, which I think it's all in credit to David Mamet, who I think wrote the screenplay, but I don't know if he, I think he took his name off it, but I think most of that.
He's credited with Steven Zalian.
He is, oh, they are, he did
yeah,
get,
yeah, he's in the credits.
I couldn't remember, I remember there was a huge hoo-ha about it at the time, and I think you can hear the Mamet lines, because you just know his lines, they kind of zing out at you, and I'm sure that's one of his. But I was ultimately always feel, when I do watch Hannibal, kind of let down by it.
Yeah.
And it, which is a, it's such idea, and I don't know. But I remember I think I felt a little let down by the novel as well, the way Silence just lives up to the book brilliantly.
I think that's Silence of the Lambs is a tough novel as well as film to follow. Both of them are just absolute perfection. I've read Silence a couple of times, and I've read Red Dragon quite a bit. Red Dragon's my favorite of the series of the novels, and I am absolutely in love with the Will Graham character, and particularly how William Peterson portrays that character. I think William Peterson is dead on. He looks like Will Graham. It's interesting when I watch the film Red Dragon, and it's pretty much verbatim from the film Manhunter, which was verbatim from the novel Red Dragon, the Will Graham monologues when he's in the Leeds house and he is talking into that tape recorder. It's funny watching Edward Norton because it's him repeating William Peterson's lines from Manhunter.
I mean,
that's the way I see it, or hear it.
It's really unusual that if you think about how much Thomas Harrison's writing remains almost verbatim intact to the movies. Most novels into screenplays into novels. Novels and screenplays, sorry, in the movies, there's a lot lost and a lot gets diluted and a lot gets changed almost to the point where you don't recognize it. And yet, the Thomas Harris, it is literally huge chunks of dialogue and word for word. There is very little added by the screenwriter. I think it's because the screenwriter, Michael Mann and Ted Talley just went, how can I improve on this material? And it's unusual in that way. Most novels, most adaptions, completely change the book in some way, or take a different tack or a different tangent. The Thomas Harris novels don't. They're incredibly faithful.
Right. I guess you could say with Manhunter, they changed the ending.
Well, actually,
quite a bit.
No, that was by necessity, not by design. They literally ran out of money.
Right.
And Michael Mann couldn't shoot the whole thing on the beach. And they had to just, literally ran out of money. And if you've seen the documentaries, Michael Mann said, they were down to a skeleton crew. The blood squibs were, the artist, production guy, throwing blood at them. They didn't even have squibs.
Yeah, wasn't it blowing ketchup out of a straw?
Yeah, blowing
ketchup. Or something like that?
So they literally ran out of money. So all that stuff, which is in the novel, he didn't decide not to shoot it. He just couldn't shoot it. He didn't cut it out. They literally ran out of money, and the movie had to end there because it kind of just cuts to him going home, doesn't it?
That's the end of the film,
yeah,
right?
And it's just they ran out. So all that stuff that happens in the novel, it wasn't Michael Mann's intent not to use it. He just couldn't because it ends on a freeze frame.
Yes, classic 80s with pop music. I love it on the beach with his family.
Yeah,
I do really enjoy the ending of Manhunter, though. I like the ending of the Red Dragon novel, and Brett Ratner's film uses that same ending verbatim. But I do really like the ending to Manhunter with the slow motion of William Peterson jumping through the glass window to Indagata DeVita by Iron Butterfly, and Dolarhyde just picking him up off the ground and slicing his face with the broken glass. I think it's absolutely wonderful, and I love it. I think the soundtrack to Manhunter is an interesting soundtrack. I bought it. It was hard to track down for a very long time. There was just bootlegs on eBay, but it finally got released, and you can buy it on Amazon's music store for $5. But it's a very interesting soundtrack, particularly that band Shriekback that has quite a few tracks that are very haunting throughout the film, particularly the scene where Joan Allen and Tom Noonan are making love, the sex scene, and she's on top of him, and she's saying how strong and powerful Tom Noonan is, and it's that creepy, creepy, almost African horn tribal music.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
That's playing. It's very good, and it adds that adds that even more creep factor, because Tom Noonan, you're right. I mean, Tom Noonan owns that film. He is just absolutely terrifying in that film.
Everything about him, and also it's an inspired piece of casting. I mean, I think another Michael Mann regular.
Yeah,
he's the guy in the wheelchair in Heat, isn't he?
He's Kelso.
Just beamed out there. He's going out to grab it, and he. It's just this inspired piece of casting. He just looks, he's so strange looking, and so scary. But at the same, you kind of feel for him because of his relationship with Joan Allen's character. He's incredibly sad, and there's that amazing shot again, which we're talking about, where Will Graham. Slow-mo comes through the window, but he walks through the piece of it's I don't know what it is, it's like a psych, and he just steps through it with the shotgun. It kind of splits open, and he steps through. It's an amazing kind of moment. He's the dominating monster in that movie. He is like the Frankenstein monster. He looks like, I always thought he should have been cast as Frank, as the creature in the Frankenstein, because he has all that. His proportions are so strange. He has this odd-looking face and everything. I think he's brilliant in front. And, you know, God, he's not the actor that Ralph Fiennes is. But Ralph Fiennes never gets to that level that Tom Noonan does. Talking about music, I have to say this. The music for Silence of the Lambs, the end piece of I have put on three, and I play it all the time. It's one of my favorite movie score moments. It's Howard Shore, and it's the music that it's literally the end titles, and it's a great piece of music if you listen to it. Very un-horror movie like. It's quite romantic, and the final shot, which is this long take of where Hopkins just walks off through the crowd and disappears, and it just stays on this long take of people milling around and just with the titles. Great soundtrack by Howard Shore. You get a chance to download it. I love it. It's one of my favorite pieces of, movie music. It's the soundtrack to Silence.
Yeah, I think that there's not too much pop music in or popular music in Silence of the Lambs. There's obviously Petty's American Girl, which every time I hear that song, I think of the film. Yeah. I think that there's a great correlation between the two. And then, obviously, Goodbye Horses, the Q Lazarus song where Ted Levine does the dance in front of the camera, which is iconic, man. I mean, that's one of the most iconic things about Silence of the Lambs and how terrifying Ted Levine is in that film.
He was good and sort of, don't you think that sort of ruined him, like, unfortunately, like, when you played that role so well? I love him as an actor, and I love when he pops up in things, but it feels like once you've done that role and you've, shown everybody your mangina and you're dancing around like that, where do you go from there?
Because he has that weird, he has that amazing kind of, was it, she's like a big prop person? And I say that all the time. My missus, we say all that. To each other, mm-hmm. part of our kind of dialogue to each other is, and he puts the lotion on himself. I mean,
puts the lotion on its skin or gets the hose again.
Yeah, gets the hose again. But the problem is, whenever the poor actor turns up, Ted Levine turns up anything else, that becomes the screensaver in my head with him. And it interrupts the performance because all I hear is, she's not a big fat person. She puts the lotion. No matter what he's saying or what movie, even when he's being a kind of nice guy in movies,
right?
Because his voice is so distinctive. He has that weird kind of hair lip and everything. And
so somebody needs to cast him in like a touching father son drama where it's like nothing but sweetness and sensitivity.
But it's not going to happen because just in the back of your head.
Now he's just like the cop in a lot of stuff. he's kind of transitioned to that. I will say, though, I thought he was – he gave the best performance in Shutter Island. I thought he was fantastic in Shutter Island as the warden.
Oh, yeah.
I absolutely loved him in that. And that scene with Leo and Levine in the Jeep.
I really need to watch fantastic. Shutter Island again. I love that movie. I got to watch it again.
Well, I think it's funny you should talk about that, because I think Shutter Island owes so much to Silence of the Lambs. I mean, Scorsese plays a massive debt. The way the look and the photography and the style of it, and it's interesting, you're right, he casts... He's like, he's kind of, Ted Levine's like Clancy, is it Clancy Brown, the other guy? They're sort of interchangeable. They're always, it's like the guy, they're always playing like wardens, and that. It's kind of the one who's the evil warden in Shawshank Redemption, you know, he's going to throw through. They're those guys. They're the perpetual scary bad guys. And actually, can you just to talk about one trivial? Do you all know this? Do you know who the one actor is who's been in all the Hannibal movies?
Frankie Faison.
Yeah, well done.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was in. He was like a cop. He was the cop at the end of Manhunter running the information.
Yeah. I love when he pops up in Hannibal in the beginning with the mask.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's selling all the Hannibal Lecter memorabilia to Mason Verger.
Yeah.
He has a huge role. Barney has a huge role in the novel.
He does. There's a huge. It's almost there's chapters on him, isn't there? About his
right
life and there's him selling the stuff and
his relationship with Margot. Mason Verger's sister. Yeah. Barney's a huge role. Has a huge role in. In the novel.
There's a few chapters which are just about him and about his
and
what he's doing, talking about his brothers and his back. You find everything about who Barney is in the Hannibal novel. You find all his background and everything. There's a couple of chapters just devoted to him, his character. And the guys, you're right, that Frankie, what, I think he's not in Hannibal Rising. That's the only, I'm waiting for him to, does he appear in Hannibal the TV series?
No, but he should somewhere. I don't know why they haven't cast him yet.
They'll get him for a guest role, probably.
Yeah, they should. They absolutely should.
Well, I don't think Barney has been in the show. They've had a couple like orderlies or guards or whatever, but I don't think the actual character of Barney has been in the show. Well, the interesting thing about the show is they don't have the film rights to Silence of the Lambs.
So they can't use Clarice.
They can't use Clarice, and I think that's what that Anna Chlumsky character is supposed to be. That character, you know what I mean? The FBI agent that Crawford trained, that just disappeared trying to find the Chesapeake Ripper or whatever. Because the new season, which I haven't watched, but it's on right now, it kind of is where the Hannibal film or the Hannibal novel takes place. It's like Hannibal on the Lam. And it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see where they take it. Because here's my thing with Hannibal. What I never understood about the Thomas Harris novels is why Will Graham never came back. He's mentioned in passing.
He is.
And in the novel Silence of the Lambs, about I think Starling asks about Crawford, and he says that Crawford says his face looks like some damn Picasso painting because it was all cut up from the Tooth Fairy. And then I think Lecter asks Starling about Graham, and she said that he's living in Florida or whatever. But I don't understand how, when the novel Hannibal happens, that storyline, how is there not even a chapter where Crawford or somebody or Starling's going to try and talk to Will Graham about catching Lecter?
Yeah, that is.
I mean, why wouldn't you go back to the well with the guy who originally caught him that probably knows him the best? Why wouldn't you try and get him?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting that Graham does never appear in Hannibal, and it's quite odd that he doesn't. And
right,
it both in the, and you're right, that would have been a perfect moment to go back and. Even if it's just you write, it's a scene or a chapter.
Right.
And you write, you go back to the well and you say, okay, so this is where it all started. I find the Hannibal, both the book and the movie, very disjointed. And it's kind of got that, it isn't as bad as sort of Godfather 3. But there's a lot of, as again, it become just, as I said, become too much of a black comedy for me. I actually, funny enough, I was going to kind of rewatch it again, just when we were, you know, talking about to do this, and I just never got around to it. But I think it needs a revisit for us. I think to sort of re-see what I kind of make of it after all this time, after having watched the first two and the first two stand up so well, still.
Right, that's why I was excited for the Hannibal TV show, because it was supposed to take place prior to Red Dragon, and it was supposed to be the relationship between Graham and Lecter, and I was really looking forward to that, because Graham was always my favorite character in the Hannibal Lecter series, and I always thought Graham was the most interesting. Well, I mean, aside from Lecter, I think that Graham was just a fascinating character, and I was really, you know, kind of let down by the show. I think that the production value is insane. I think Mads is brilliant as Lecter and puts his own unique spin on it. I just really dislike the portrayal of Graham, where he's this schizophrenic.
I can see why they did it, because I think probably by the time, I mean, Will Graham's been kind of that character, the obsessive cop, has been sort of knocked off so many. I mean, it's been sort of redone. And I think they had to take a very, I can see why they made that decision to take it that way. Because otherwise, I think they were concerned that it would probably just be like some police procedural. And it's shot almost like a nightmare. I mean, the whole movie's shot like a sort of very odd horror movie. It's like, you know, it's almost like, you know, very Cronenberg. At times, it's like the Dead Zone, you know, the Cronenberg,
just right,
where he's in the visions.
Yes.
And you know, he plays it all kind of geeky and nerdy and kind of like, you know, sort of like a kind of strange guy who is suffering from, he's like a schizophrenic. He plays it all kind of mentally ill. Because there's no wife or kids. There's no, just him and the dogs in this house. I kind of understand the decisions they've made. To create their own version of that story, and I can understand why they did it. Whether you like it or not is, you know, whether you feel it's successful, I can probably understand why some people go, yeah, I don't, no, it doesn't work for me. It's held my interest. I genuinely don't think it's as good as what Silence is in Manhunter, but I'm sort of enjoying the journey. That's my kind of view
because, on that. Because I haven't seen it, and I am looking forward to seeing it at some point, does the fact that it's on a network feel like it's limited in any sort of way with the territory?
No, it's the opposite.
No way.
It is incredibly ghoulish.
And I can't believe how I can't believe they get away with what they get away
so
with.
At no point do you feel like this should have been on HBO or FX or something?
The only thing that would have been different is they would have said fuck.
Yeah.
I feel like. I mean, it's so violent.
It's actually
and
more
dark.
It's more violent. It's more violent than both Manhunter is actually not that violent. You don't see a lot of violence in Manhunter.
No, what's the scariest thing in Manhunter? I mean, aside from Noonan's performance, I think it's the first time Graham is in the Leeds house and he flips the light on in the all-white bedroom and there's just pools of blood.
Yeah.
And blood sprays everywhere. I mean, that's grotesque. Yeah. But yeah, you're right.
The opening scene of Manhunter is unsettling. I mean, it's, you're right. Like, it was not a bloody, gory film. And yeah, so I haven't seen the TV show, and I'm looking forward to checking
Hannibal
it out. So
TV shows is one of the most, even for kind of horror movie, it is incredibly gruesome and bizarre, and they don't shirk away from showing the violence and the aftermath and some of the, you know, you get, you know, them standing over these kind of mutilated corpses, you get the shots. So it is in no way, it is actually comparing to the movies, to the TV show, the TV show is infinitely more violent. I mean, did you find that, Frank? Because I did. I'm like, whoa.
Oh, how violent the show is compared to the films? Oh, yeah.
they're like
Hannibal the movie was pretty violent, but yeah, way more violent than the other two. In Hannibal, you have somebody getting their bowels taken out. You know, remember like he disembowels Giancarlo Esposito, and you get obviously the brain thing at the end, which borders again on like black. You know, it's black comedy as well as it's horror. But yeah, it's interesting to see, especially with recent reviewing, you know, recent revisits of Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter, that the really grisly, nasty sort of modern violence that's infected all horror movies and thrillers was, you know, pretty much absent in Manhunter and used sparingly but very effectively in The Silence of the Lambs. I mean, what? The worst part of The Silence of the Lambs is the bit with the skin on the face, right?
Yeah, where he pulls the where he's in the ambulance.
Yes.
What's funny, when you see Silence now, it's shocking how unviolent it really is.
Exactly. It's the same thing with Seven. Seven was a movie that got flack for being unbelievably violent, and when you go back and watch it, yeah, it's nasty and it holds your face really close to some really grisly stuff, but that movie leaves way more up to your imagination than most people gave it credit for doing. I remember that film was slammed by a lot of critics by saying that it was too in love with violence and too in love with its, you know, with the depravity of the situation. But I think that was an ill comment made by some people.
Oh, it's interesting now when you revisit movies. I remember Seven, and the other one was Reservoir Dogs. Everybody raving about the violence in both those movies at the time. And Reservoir Dogs is so unviolent. You would think that it was some glorified shoot 'em up, and it isn't at all. And the same with Seven. You're right. When Seven came out, it was lambasted for how in love it was with sort of the bloodshed. When in fact, when you watch it now, it is all implied.
Yeah.
You know the famous thing is everybody thinks they've seen Gwyneth Paltrow's head in a box, and of course, you never see it at all. You don't see anything. It's just you imagine it.
You see a couple of strands of hair, and that's it.
That's it. You just see a strand of hair and a tiny.
And then he shows you that really quick flash of her face before he blows away Kevin Spacey. But I mean everything is left up to your imagination, and you know, and that's always the mark of an intelligent filmmaker, where he trusts the viewer to follow his lead or her lead. And, you know, you don't need to show everything, and you can allow people to use their own brains, and what you don't see sometimes can be worse than what you could ever put in front of somebody with special effects or, you know, a body or like a dummy. So,
well, it's interesting if you think about the body count in both the movies. Most of the violence happens off screen.
Mm-hmm.
In Manhunter and Silence of the Lambs. You hear about stuff, you don't actually see. I'm trying to think other Hannibal here, and he hits the guy with the, you know, that's the only kind of on-screen murder apart from at the very end where Jodie Foster shoots. That's it. That's the only on-screen murder. That's the only one killed on screen in Silence. Am I right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And when Andy Hopkins beats the poor prison guard, you actually don't see anything because it's from the prison guard's point of view, and it's that he's doing this kind of very graceful kind of balletic thing with the truncheon,
the nightstick, where he's hissing at him and just blood spraying all over his white shirt.
Yeah. And you know, you don't actually see anything.
No.
Same with at the very end, she fires into the Jodie Foster. Just shoots kind of in again. She shoots in the camera with the night vision, and I think that's the only deaths on screen, isn't it? That we actually see. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah,
and that's really interesting.
Yeah. And then with what, Manhunter? It's just Stephen Lang in the wheelchair on fire.
and then
at the end of the film, Dollar Hyde just shooting the cops.
Yeah.
They're trying to break into his place where he's one hand. He's shooting him one handed with a shotgun. God, it's awesome.
You know, Michael Mann moment, isn't it? Yeah.
Right, yeah. And he can just take the recoil in his gigantic body and not have to worry about anything. You know. Or when he shoots the guy that works with him at the office where he's having that, like, lucid dreamscape where he thinks the guy's kissing her or whatever, and he's just taking the pollen off of her lapel or something like that.
Yeah, but he kind of just pulls him out of frame, though, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He steps through the kind of shrubbery and pulls him out of frame.
Yeah, and you just hear the silenced gun go off.
Yeah, you don't kind of see it. It's very interesting that both movies, the on-screen body count is really quite low, given the nature of the subject.
The subject, right.
Yeah, you never see the serial killers kill anyone on screen. You never see the Tooth Fairy kill anyone.
No, you're right.
You never see his murder. You don't see him cut up the bodies or all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, or like arrange the bodies and put the pieces of the broken mirror, or even him stalking the bodies. You see Graham in the footsteps of Dollarhide in the forest, or in the woods behind the house, and retracing his steps throughout the house, but you never see Dollarhide do those acts. You just see Graham reenacting them.
It's his POV. And the same with Silence of the Lambs. You never see Jamie Gubb kill any of the girls.
No.
I mean, you just have what's her name in the you know, she
in the pit.
In the pit. What do they call the actress again? She's terrific.
Oh, what's her name? She was in Ray Donovan.
Oh,
she's very
yeah, she's
good.
Great. I love that girl. She's always in. Yeah, she's in Weird Donovan, and she's in. Oh shit! Oh my god! I know what she's always pops up in Law and Order.
I'm trying to remember her name.
Oh, it's going to come to me any second now because I remember. I always know. She's always.
Hang on.
Don't know right, and she's in.
To the IMDb, I go.
No, let me guess, because it'll kill me to remember who she is. Oh, I remember. I got her name now. How could I not forget? Brooke Smith.
Yeah.
Brooke Smith, the actress, you're right. She's in Ray Donovan. She's the nurse. She's Eddie, what's her name's nurse in it.
Right.
Yeah, she's terrific, and she's great. All that, which is in the pair. But it's, again, what is interesting about both directors make these decisions not to show the violence. A movie that is about violence, you never actually say it. It's all off screen.
Right, and you know if either one of those films were made today, there would just be, you would see James Gunn kidnapping the women and killing them and starving them and cutting open their bodies and pulling the skin off, and you know you'd see Dollarhide going into somebody's house
shooting
them and rearranging the bodies and breaking the mirror with his fist.
Which is what the TV series does. Because Hannibal the TV series shows you the murder. Will Graham, like the Dead Zone, flashes into character, and he sometimes commits the murders. So you always see the murders in the TV show, much more than you do the movies. I wonder if that's just a change of the time and how we've, our view of what movie violence is permissible.
I think it's both that and then the vision of the filmmaker as well. And I think Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter are very cerebral, and where you're terrified and haunted by the stuff that goes on off screen that affects the characters that we're seeing on screen, you know, like Will Graham gets caught in his own mind many of time in Manhunter, where he sees Mrs. Leeds rise up from the bed, and she has like the light coming out of her eyes and the light coming out of her mouth, and you know, he wakes up in the airplane because that little girl's freaking out next to him because he's got the pictures of the dead families like on a binder in front of him. You know, it's very good, and it's very smart the way both Demme and Mann sort of did that. It'd be interesting. I'm sure I could find it online somewhere if I Google it, but I'd like to hear each other's, Demme's thoughts on Manhunter and Mann's thoughts on Silence of the Lambs in detail.
Have you listened to the audio commentary from either of them? I know there's an audio commentary of Michael Mann somewhere on Manhunter.
I have listened to the Mann commentary on Manhunter, but it's been a while, and I have not listened to the commentary on the Silence of the Lambs.
I need to listen to both.
I have, I have the Criterion Laserdisc and the Criterion Blu-ray or Criterion DVD of Silence of the Lambs. I don't own it on Blu-ray.
There's a great documentary on the Blu-ray, the British Blu-ray of Silence of the Lambs. And it's incredible. Everybody's talking about it. And the only reference they make to Manhunter is it was a decision made not to reference that film at all and to go the other way. And that's the only kind of... And I don't think Anthony Hopkins had seen Manhunter at all. So I don't think he was kind of, you know, and him and Hopkins know each other. But I think it was a conscious effort probably on Demis's part not, you know, to do everything the complete opposite, which was a smart move and make his own movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're two different... They're two standalones that complement each other but don't need to rely or reference each other whatsoever.
So, Frank, gun to your head, since this is it Manhunter? If you have to pick one on your desert island, which one's it going to be?
I'll be Manhunter.
Okay. Nick?
The overall preference?
Yeah. Gun to your head.
I would, first, it would be Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
Gary?
Gun to my head, Silence. But it's a hair's breadth. But
it's really due to me seeing one way more than the other. And I'm a massive Michael Mann fan. I mean, I'm more of a Mann fan than I am a Demme fan. Not that I don't really enjoy Demme's films. But I've just seen Silence of the Lambs so much. I had a chance to watch it. Basically frame by frame, and whenever I don't know if you guys had a chance to do such a thing ever, I'll never look at that movie again in the same way simply because of my, you know, the intense experience I had sort of studying it in college. But one thing that was abundantly clear watching Manhunter on Friday night and then the last half hour of it last night again is that I need to watch it with the commentary, and I do need to see it a few more times because it really strikes me as just like the you know, the sort of the base ground for Mann to, you know, his big jumping off point, like we talked about earlier.
Yeah, no, I mean, Mann is an incredible filmmaker. He's a master. And it's interesting that he's a better filmmaker than Jonathan Demme. And that's not to take anything away from Demme. But if you took their body of work, and Demme's made some great movies. But if you put, you know, you kind of compared the two, you would say Mann was a better filmmaker just in his body of work. Yet, I would say that Silence is the better movie of the two, just in terms of how it's constructed, how beautifully played it is. Christ, it won three Oscars, a whole bunch of Oscars, and is iconic. It's iconic filmmaking. I mean, it's a movie that as of his performance, culture. Everybody knows the line, you know, I ate a fava beans with a nice Chianti and all that stuff. It's iconic. And also, it's one of the few Oscar... I mean, what an unusual Oscar winner. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, that's... It's interesting you said it was up against JFK, which is a phenomenal piece of filmmaking. JFK, there's a whole thing about JFK. There's 12 hours about that piece of cinema, and that's what it is, pure cinema. But...
One of the best movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, a phenomenal piece of filmmaking. I mean, just how that came out of his mind, I don't know, because it's just all over the place, and there's an amazing amount of information.
Can you imagine editing that?
The editing in that movie is just—it's a masterclass on editing and more than just like the physical actions of editing, but like, how do you even see that film edited together? I mean, I don't even understand how. You know, you got filmmakers who edit while they're shooting, and then you guys got that edit afterwards, and I'm always blown away by just how that was put together, how he had the vision to have it all. Same thing goes for Nixon.
Well, I mean, that's the amazing thing about Stone. Both those movies. I remember when I saw JFK at the cinema when it came out, and nothing looked like that. Nobody had tackled the subject in that way. It was so original. It is pure cinema, you know, the use of all these different mediums and everything, and the subject matter and what he said and how much information he gets across. It's a piece of art. And yet, you put it up against Silence of the Lambs, it's just, you want to sit down and watch a movie from A to B to C and everybody watch it and everybody get it. It's not perfect. And it's real unusual. I mean, what a film to win an Oscar. It's the first and only horror film that's won, or what it would be called, a horror film. And it's probably one of the few Oscars that I wouldn't give back. You know, sometimes if you redo the Oscars and you go back and you redo them, there's a whole bunch of movies that you go, that one?
Right. No, I agree. And I agree with everything you guys said in comparing and contrast to Manhunter. I think that for cinema, Silence of the Lambs is clearly the superior film to Manhunter with how it's made and how it looks and how cinematic it is. But there's the part of me that loves Manhunter because it's rough. And because it's dirty, and because it's not as cinematic as Silence of the Lambs is. I mean, I'll wrap things up here, but before I do, the scene, my favorite scene that still gives me goosebumps or makes the hair raise on the back of my arms, is at the end of Manhunter when Crawford and Graham are in the hotel room and everything comes to Graham's mind of how he pieces everything together and he realizes that Dollar Hyde has seen these films and he realizes that Dollar Hyde is working at the transfer place where they're transferring right. film to video and out of focus almost is Dennis Farina behind him and he starts to back up because he's frightened of Graham of how Graham was able to, you know, momentarily go inside of Dollar Hyde and be able to put all the puzzle pieces together. It's terrifically shot and acted, and it's always affected me in the same way even after my 2000th viewing that I watched this weekend. But yeah, so I'm going to wrap things up here. We're at our sign-off time. But yeah, this was a great conversation. I was looking forward to this all week. I was so excited to talk about these two films, obviously because I love Manhunter and I love Silence of the Lambs, and I know the three of us have a strong passion for both of the films. So Gary, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, Gary, thank you very much for coming on and giving your, you know, great expertise as always.
Thank you very much. I can't think of anything better I'd like to do on a Sunday afternoon.
That's great. Yeah, same here. I mean, it's absolutely wonderful. So we'll be back next month with Gary, where we're going to be doing two more films. I don't know if we've made up our minds what they're going to be, but we have a couple that we've been rolling around. I don't know. Do we want to say what they are, or do we just want to have it be a surprise?
Oh, let's
whatever you guys think. We had thrown around a couple of the options, but really, whatever you guys want to do, we'd thrown around L.A. Confidential and Chinatown, and then Sorcerer and Wages of Fear. So I'm down for either one of those.
What do you think, Gary? What do you want to do?
Let's do L.A. Confidential in Chinatown next month, and then we'll do Wages of Fear and Sorcerer the month after.
That sounds awesome. Great.
Executive decision.
Executive decision by Gary Young. Very good.
With Steven Seagal and Kurt Russell?
Yeah.
probably not that executive decision.
Okay.
Which is
all good.
Which is the best movie Steven Seagal's ever done.
Because
I like Under
Siege.
Because
he died in the first 15
Come on.
Years.
Under Siege is great. All right.
Yeah, okay.
We'll catch you guys soon.
Absolutely.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks a lot, Gary.